You are listening to Talking Earth. This is Patrick Bocard, host of the Talking Earth, and you're listening to KBO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial. And I'm here in the studio with John Sibley Williams, who's the editor of two Northwest poetry anthologies and the author of 9 collections. He's a 5-time Pushcart nominee and winner of the Philip Booth Award, American Literary Review Poetry Contest, Nancy D. Hargrove Editor's Prize, and Vellum Award for Poetry. He's an editor of the Inflectionist Review and works as a literary agent. His previous publishing credits include the Midwest Quarterly December. Those are different magazines. I'm sorry. Third Coast, Baltimore Review, Nimrod International Journal, Hotel America with a K, Rio Grande Review, Inkwell, Cider Press Review, Bryant Literary Review, Rhino, and various anthologies. And he lives here in Portland, Oregon. He's also published a recent book, Disinheritance, a very impressive book of poetry, and also has some new poems he'd like to share with us, wouldn't you, John?
Well, thank you so much for having me, Patrick. I really appreciate it, and it's a pleasure to be here. It's been a few years since I've been here at KBO.
It's been a little while, yeah.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful station. I love listening to it, and thank you.
Yeah, well, then enjoy having you here too. Do you want to read a poem?
Sure, and. I think just because, if I may, as opposed to starting with a poem or two from my new collection, although I look forward to maybe doing that later, given the, shall we say, cultural and political turmoil, both nationwide and here in our lovely city, I thought I would actually start, if I may, with a poem called Inauguration. It begins with a line from William Stafford's poem, At the Unnational Monument Along the Canadian Border, one of my favorite poems of his. Stafford begins his poem with the line, This is the field where the battle did not happen. Such a beautiful line. And the last line of this poem is a tweaked version of the last line of his poem. This poem is titled Inauguration. A map had been drawn here. Once a hand guided a thin strand of oak over autumn earth, carving the earth into countries that winter preserved for as long as it could. As a child at first calls everything mother, we know this fragile outline washing away in the rain as America, as an old red barn burning through morning fog, our names sung over cloud-swept fields by apple pies cooling on sills. Discarded scrap metal, and are making something beautiful from it. Black blood shed, holding tight the lips of half-healed wounds, as less than half of an already incomplete narrative. Still, might this be the image that endures us? America, the tender, home, echo of itself, fleeting flame? Would I have fought harder had I known freedom could end with such a gentle gesture? A wall, a broken oath that's kept, just a single hour of rain. Here, where we tremble like any waning thing. No, the only heroic thing is not the sky. Mr. Stafford ended his poem with the only heroic thing is the sky. And I would like to think that that is not the case. I think a lot of people are proving that that's not the case in the streets recently.
No, I think... Sorry, I'm conflating it with very unpoetic ideas and unfortunately a blockbuster movie. There's a Guardians of the Galaxy 2 opens with a ELO song, Mr. Blue Sky, and if you listen to it, it's all about, you know, talking about why did the Mr. Blue Sky leave.
Mm-hmm.
Going by the narrative of that movie, which, I mean, I enjoyed it, but other people haven't. It's about, it implies Mr. Blue Sky is God. It's we've always had this idea of someone, you know, the sky god,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I'm not going to give anything away about the movie though. So we'll move on, but that's just, yeah, I would hope I would say a lot of heroic acts have nothing to do with the sky whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And some heinous ones do have to do with the sky.
Very, yes.
Or sky god. But I'll leave it at that. If you want to read another poem and get me out of this,
sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah, let's. actually, if I may, just kind of sticking with that topic, another poem fairly related is called The Crossing. Tell me what not to do with heaven-faced children torn between parents who are torn apart by a river, tearing a long muddy scar into this long and lengthening landscape. Then tell me again why we are the only animal bound by maps, shifting allegiances. Tell me what not to forgive of stars, what skin my skin is forbidden from touching, what heart my heart cannot possibly hold without breaking. Don't tell me the best way to break a body without damaging the shell. We all know how that story ends. Ask the bridled horses. Ask mothers waiting by docks for warships never to return. Ask any long, cold winter night in any part of any country, any child has ever fled to find herself no closer to home. Please tell me what road that begins in ruin ends somewhere beautiful. Don't write too often about such topics, but sometimes one is moved to.
Yeah, that's a... I don't know. I feel like I've gotten a little sidetracked since the election as well, like in terms of what I've been writing as opposed to what I was writing before.
Yeah, there's just so much human pain that I think is being forgotten, talked over, erased, in some cases actively erased, in some cases just forgotten, the human element of all of this, of everything that's going on there, the human consequences.
And yeah, it just... Yeah, I don't know. It's we live in interesting times, and that's not a good... And according to the Chinese, that's not a good thing.
Although I guess it could be argued what times aren't interesting, but there are some pretty radical shifts in every decade, right? In every generation, but this could be a big one. This is our generation's, it seems.
I'd like to get back to the poetry, but I would argue that a lot of the whole... In terms of the politicians involved, other than, say, some radical right-wingers you and I wouldn't agree with, but are not exactly behaving badly at the moment, or just Paul Ryan and Ted Cruz, most of the people that are, you know, everyone is in such a fuss about are baby boomers still,
mm-hmm.
and that they haven't really relinquished power, and that's kind of been an issue. And that our generation hasn't been that interested in joining politics.
That's true. It seems like they
we need the millennials to save us, mm-hmm. because we haven't done it.
Exactly, yeah. And I think I've certainly read many articles about it, not to get too far from the poetry by any means, but definitely I think that this might be the turning point in that regard. You know, people are taking to the streets. People, I know I've read some articles, you know, people are joining very active organizations, things like that, at rates that far supersede, you know, than they ever have.
Yeah.
And that has been just within the past, you know, 12 months or so, you know, be it earlier during the campaign with Sanders, with the Green Party, with other movements, but especially now, you know, so maybe this is a turning point when people have to realize how dark something can be before they actually get involved.
I think it's also, I think the polarization is a very... I mean, that's one of the main issues. I mean, the irony is that Bernie Sanders is the most popular politician in the United States right now, and he has been for a while. You know, Trump was not anywhere near as popular as him, as a bunch of other Republicans and or Democrats, but he wasn't on the table, so
yeah.
Yeah, but it's just, yeah.
Yeah, our system is all about who is placed on the table.
Let's go back to the poetry piece. I don't think we're going to solve this problem.
No, not right here in a little room, just two of us? No?
Okay. No. Do you want to read from your Disinheritance?
I would love to. Yeah, sure. Thank you for asking. And these poems have none of that in there, so we'll move very, very quickly from that topic.
They're much more about grief and...
They are, yeah. Actually, when composing this book, which, I mean, it was published late last year, so therefore, you know, the poems are for the most part written the year before, you know, and you publish them in magazines and such, and then submit to book publishers. So these were written quite a while ago, and obviously there were a number of, as you can probably tell from reading it, there are a number of personal things that I was going through, but also I try to write poetry somewhat more from a fictional standpoint.
Okay.
You know, so a lot of the situations or I don't want to say characters, but aren't necessarily me, but they're coming from the same place of what I was going through.
But also, if I'm remembering inflectionism, there's supposed to be a certain amount of mystery involved in that, right?
Oh, absolutely.
So we're not going to tell anyone what's fiction and what's not.
I absolutely agree. I've been asked that actually at reading sometimes when people are like, so is this... Did this specific thing happen to you, or did this particular is this particular poem something that's more fictionalized, or something that you know is this narrative is yours? And I don't answer that because it doesn't matter. You know, the poem, any poem has to stand for itself regardless, right? If you have a book and you're sitting at home with it, you can't ask the person questions. So, you know, composition questions, metaphorical questions, things like that are great, but I'm not a big fan of author intent questions because I'm not one of those that thinks it matters. You know, some people care about author intent, you know, as a reader. And personally, I think that the poem stands for itself or it doesn't. So yeah, some of these, I won't tell you of whatever we end up reading here and out of the book. I definitely won't mention which ones are the correct ones. But yeah, I can say though it's pretty interesting because some of the poems, in trying to deal with grief, the whole collection really is about grief, but I was trying to adopt different voices. So I do have... like a child who had lost a parent, in this case, a mother. I also adopted the voice of, for example, a parent who had lost a child. I have the probably the hardest one. I have a series of poems called the Dead Boy series because that's so cheerful. that they all begin with, you know, a dead boy does something, and that's the perspective of a child who's passed, who is somehow still in communication or trying to communicate with the living world. So I tried to adopt a bunch of different voices, most of which weren't necessarily mine. But yeah, in this, so I guess the very first poem in the book, which is titled Bone River, is the first of four Bone Rivers that kind of repeat throughout the book. Our child experiments with her limbs, displacing air and waiting for the vacancy to fill. Such a raw gesture, raw and enigmatic remorse. What is it here I have done and am waiting for? For what it's worth, love, a stone asks the same question of the river. Have I broken you yet? And it's interesting, there are a number of poems here from a parent talking to a hypothetical child, and at the time I didn't have any. Now that I have children, I find it very interesting that a lot of the things I'm contemplating are things I actually am contemplating now that I'm the father of twins. You know, not a single day goes by in which I don't ask myself if I've broken them yet. You know, you know, at one point will I have broken them? Hopefully not yet.
Hopefully you won't.
Or not at all. Yeah.
Yes.
but you know, I think every parent has that. And a lot of the poems in here coming from that perspective, I found the vast majority end up being how I feel now, even though at the time my wife and I at the time were, you know, struggling to try to have children. It wasn't working out while I was writing the poem. So I was trying to put myself in that mindset.
You were kind of imagining how you would feel.
Yeah, as a parent, exactly.
A lot of this book, I mean, it's grief, but it's also imagining.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of it was taking, for the most part, most of the poems were taking some kernel or core of truth or a personal experience. And then, I guess, imagining a world around that. Which I think for the most part, except for maybe particularly narrative poems, I think for the most part, that's maybe how, I'm going to guess, how a lot of people approach, you know, composing poetry, I think, is finding a kernel that's true to them, to their experience, their perspective, whatever, and then expanding from that, you know, fictionalizing it or doing whatever. So many poems in this collection, but elsewhere, somehow I seem to have a brother in a lot of, I don't have a brother, I'm an only child, but I seem to have a brother that keeps showing up in lots of poems.
The poetic brother.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know. I'm not quite sure why that's the case, but yeah. And you just expand from it. I think, to me, at least, as long as the core is authentic, then the rest doesn't matter as much.
No. And I kind of agree. I think some people actually don't, they come from like, they have to write nonfiction poetry,
mm-hmm.
Or people listening often assume everything in a poem is true,
mm-hmm.
and it's about your life. And I've never operated from that. I mean, but it's a lot easier to get away, it's a lot more obvious that you're writing fiction when you're writing about a giant radioactive turtle hurtling through outer space or the stuff I write about.
Well, actually, let me read this poem about a giant radioactive. No.
You don't have one. I know that.
That was a personal experience. No.
Anyway.
I'm
getting a sidetracked again. We need to get back. Let's get back to some.
Although there was a poem somewhere, I didn't plan on reading it. Not one of my favorites to read necessarily. You know, some poems just sound better out loud than others. There is a poem in here that has to do with Oppenheimer. So that's interesting enough. I don't think there are any radioactive turtles or anything, but it's fairly close.
Well, but that was more about a Japanese monster movie. So that's, I don't think Oppenheimer had.
I'm sure that was one of his fears when he was putting it together. One of his giant regrets, of course.
Yeah.
Was in a few years, something will emerge from the ocean and Portland's in trouble.
In a few years, the Japanese are going to make movies and make money off them about monsters radiated by the thing I just created.
Yeah.
That's what he was fearing. We're off on a monstrous tangent, and you have a poem ready to read, and I believe it's one I was hoping you would read.
Oh, okay. sure. This next poem is part of that part of the series of which there's maybe half a dozen or so, all from the perspective of a dead boy. This poem is called "A Dead Boy Speaks to His Parents." Hush now, you don't have to be anymore. Whatever script you'd written for the stars to follow, they've missed their marks, gone true right instead of stage right. Nightly, you whisper, ever since, perhaps because, or even before. But you don't have to thread cause through effect or rummage through whatever beginnings you've captured on film to discover a fixed point of my departure. The zoetrope continues to spin without image. Mom and Dad, you don't have to be contained anymore. Between the lines I never had time to write on the stars that don't listen anyway. Definitely, that was probably these poems, this perspective in those poems are definitely some of the hardest, you know, that for me to write when I was writing these, is to get into one's, you know,
get into that.
Ahead of that. And yeah.
It's also, they also use the most negative space actually in terms of the spacing on the page. And
that may have actually not been intentional.
I was kind of attracted to that. I tend to be attracted to poems that kind of, I'm a Frank Bidart fan, and he has like 30 page poems that if you just condensed them, they would probably be about 5 pages.
Mm. I'm actually a big fan of white space too. I think white space absolutely can be used in really incredible manners. I mean, there's obviously the need for a reader, right? Readers do need the white space, I think. I find it quite intimidating. I love prose poetry, but actual poems that run the entire length of a page can be intimidating in a number of ways.
Yeah, I agree.
And
but at the same, I mean, that can be necessary too. It just depends on the poem. But I just noticed that aside from that they are from an alternative voice, it was also that there was much more, you were spacing everything out kind of differently.
Oh, yeah.
And there's also another poem where you have the slashes as line breaks in the middle of the poem, but don't actually use line breaks.
Yes, I think that was something
you did some interesting experimented things with.
Which one is? I think I do that maybe in two or three poems in this, right?
Which you generally have used like white space a lot when you've been writing. I mean, that's.
Yeah. And in fact, a newer structure, not in this book, but a newer structure that I've sort of adopted is somewhat of a prose poem style, but it's actually very short lines. So that having a huge amount of white space on the right-hand side and kind of a, you know, kind of a cascade of short lines moving down the page. That's something else that I've been experimenting with the past 6 months or so. Just trying to use white space in different manners and for different voices.
It's always interesting to kind of the physical structure of a poem as well as the stuff like rhyme and alliteration and, meter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of interesting. I mean, But anyway, I just noticed that about the Dead Boy poems that they were... Now I just caught up a Dead Boy Martyrs His Mother, and that one is not so much.
Oh,
so
okay.
Perhaps I spoke too soon. But perhaps you'd like to read another poem from the book.
Sure. I'd be happy to. I was trying to find some poems that I'd marked off here that were using some of the different voices as opposed to, you know, doing a lot of Dead Boy poems, for example.
That would be great. Yeah,
and so this one definitely one can probably tell us a bit more about me, I guess. But for those who are living perhaps where they're not from, I'm from the East Coast, the Boston area originally, and I've only been back there twice since I moved to Oregon about 9 years ago now. Only visited twice. And now someone else, another family, owns the house where I was raised, and I think they have children and such also. So in seeing the house, not being able to enter it, and seeing the house from the outside that I grew up in, it just felt like such a strange foreign feeling, you know? And I'm not sure if I believe in that theory of like place memory, but that idea that, you know, the first 18 years of my life was spent in a particular room and now probably another child, I'm assuming, is in that room is such a, you know, if any part of me was still there. I'm not sure if that's the case or not, but it makes sense. There's a good argument for place memory. So it just made me wonder if there's any echo of me in this house that other people are living in. So I guess I was kind of contemplating that. This poem is called I Go to the Ruined Place. Immigrant, I walk the town that raised me. I study the estranged hues of once known trees. So many blacks, whites, a handful of birds, forgotten flight patterns. I follow the street that winds along the river down to my lower lip. Shattered mirror in my blood. Brick behind my back. Windows so like my eyes stare back, foreign, from the corner house with broken lashes. Distant, I can hear a dead boy still marking the walls in crayon inside. I'm wondering if, you know, obviously one's youth is, it's a part of you, but it's also to some degree, it's also dead, you know?
It's like snakes shed their skin. It's like a shedded part of you.
Yes, is always going to be there. Yeah.
It's also interesting when you actually go back to somewhere and you go inside and it feels all different and off.
Mm-hmm.
It's not how you remembered it.
I know. Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad I can't enter. I'm glad it's not owned anymore. And I guess I'll moving on from that to adopt another voice. It'll be fairly clear from the poem, but I guess this particular voice of grief is parents of a miscarriage, and the title of this poem is "Away from Stillness." You leave the womb of our bed and outside wait for the weather to change again. The blood that once impregnated the sky has whitened to snow. And for 6 months, we have tried to return from barren winter to that raw place of hope. I wade deep and naked into your absent half of the mattress as you wait deep inside night, wreckage of the moon falling into your hands. through a closed window, I hear you clearing off our wounded road, so he can finally see his tiny, unformed name written in eulogy beneath all this snow. As one can imagine, yeah, it wasn't not a lot of, I guess you could say, fun, if writing poetry is per se fun. I'm not sure if that's an adjective one normally uses. It's a lot of things, obviously very passionate and worthwhile in a life's pursuit. I'm not sure if fun is normally the word, but the most of the poems in this collection were actually on the verge of difficult to write, but they felt like something that that I really wanted to explore.
But you were struggling with?
Not necessarily in writing, but emotionally struggling with, yeah. Even though, again, a lot of these aren't necessarily me, but, you know, trying to adopt these voices was emotionally taxing, shall we say, but in a good way, right? I mean, it should be if you're trying to explore a difficult concept. This next poem is called For My Mother in Parting. I guess everything you didn't know is in the title there. Written across the lake's restless surface, wide as the sun reed is a sorrowful path that relies so heavily on where it's been and where it's going, on our past burnings and the terrible ash of no longer being. It is good to remember to forget these things. It is good to forget the sun, regret, triumph, shadow, and the steady swell of time. Immense and insistent, our hearts cannot hold all the light it took to get us here. Here, where the tulips we've planted fold into hands, and our hands fold back into seed, and seed cannot stop folding and folding up into blossom. Welcome it. Mother, let's welcome everything we are not and will never be into our hands, and rub them together like clouds. Like clouds. Like impossible clouds that hold all the light of this impossible sun that will never stop folding. Yeah, that's one of the few poems where I don't mind telling people that was actually one I'd written for my mother, you know, that I got that right before her passing, you know, got to read it on her deathbed, or pretty much, and last time I saw her, and at her wake and such. So that was that was one of the few poems that I didn't actually have to adopt another voice for.
It's also, well, the end of it though is very much kind of let's welcome everything we are not. That's very much like trying on to explore other ways of being, or how other people see the world. I mean,
absolutely.
It's kind of like a metaphor for everything you're trying to do in most of the rest of the book.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that's interesting. One of the countless things, I guess, that maybe that drew me to poetry so many, I don't know, a couple decades ago at this point, was is how everyone reads metaphors differently. Like in that line, that idea of being cherishing, actually, what we're not, on some level to me, had to do with regret also. And there's no need for it. There's no purpose. Actually, everything that you didn't end up doing with your life, everything that you thought maybe you'd become that you didn't end up becoming, that's okay. You know, welcome that too. Welcome what you didn't do as much as what you did do.
It'll just roll off into a cloud and...
It's all the same. Yeah.
It's also felt like it's also kind of a metaphor for empathy, kind of in a way as well.
Oh, yeah. I'm not sure if I'd thought of it in those terms, but I definitely agree with you. Yeah. I love conversations about poetry at least half as much as reading and writing it. So because of that, I love hearing other people's perspectives, whether it's on my poetry or theirs or someone else's. But and I'm part of a critique group here in Portland. Obviously, we critique each other's work, but we also discuss, obviously, other poets and things like that. And I just love hearing, you know, multiple people's perspectives on the same poem, the same line even. And you can have, you know, a half-hour discussion, as I'm sure you know. You can have a half-hour discussion on one line, and everyone is taking something different away from it. And I just, that's amazing. That's not something you can do with necessarily with all art forms. But maybe that's kind of, on some level, the goal of most art to begin with, really, is to have some sort of human visceral reaction to it, and for it to be ambiguous enough that different people, you know, they feel however they feel toward it. What matters is that you feel it.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
No, whatsoever. it makes perfect sense, and it kind of fits in with the, I mean, I don't know if you're still consider yourself an inflectionist, but it kind of fits in with their the philosophy too, in that you don't spell it out for the reader.
Yeah. You let I think even with narrative poems, and these poems in this book are slightly more narrative for me than usual. But even with the narrative poets that I love, and Stafford can be quite a narrative poet, for example, and obviously a million contemporary poets too. Still, the ones that speak the most to me, whether it's highly narrative and personal, or highly metaphorical, or surreal, or you know, non-tangible. They seem to be talking about something that's true. You know, the experience doesn't have to be true, or can be, but there's a core, you know, that's just kind of glowing or vibrating beneath all of it, and that core is different for all of us. You know, if you pick up a poem that maybe you think it's about grief, and the poet was actually trying to discuss something else, and someone else who reads it thinks it picks up a totally different metaphor from it. To me, that's actually a beautiful thing. You know, if everyone picked up a poem or short story or anything, or looked at a piece of art, and all of us saw the exact same thing when we looked at it. You know, if everyone looks at the Mona Lisa and is like, that expression means XYZ, then it's kind of almost not, I mean, not to get, you know, on a high horse or whatever, but that's almost not art anymore, you know? Not for me to define art, but you know what? What would that be? That's a mathematical equation. If you know, this piece of art equals this.
The thing is that it's not even a mathematical equation, because you can have tons of physicists argue about one equation, and math has its own beauty in abstract. I was just thinking it'd be a bad blockbuster movie.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone, the thing that they're all saying about it is terrible.
Yeah.
That's all I would say.
It's the new Jerry Bruckheimer film. Poetry by Jerry Bruckheimer.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Not even, I guess that it has to be a really, really bad one, because, you know, there's a critic of Lamb of Week who thinks Michael Bay is a good director. So
oh, my.
Not everyone has the same opinion. And the world is better for it.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. So, absolutely.
Did you want to go on?
Sure. Absolutely.
Disinheritance.
I don't have any Michael Bay poems. Sure. I'm going to, if I may, read a poem, which was, again, one in which I was kind of imagining myself as a parent. And this is something that I'm kind of sort of going through right now, since my twins are 10 months old. The name of the poem is Teething. An unbroken wail across the long waking hours, the body beginning to know itself. Skin ruptures to make room for enamel, which is to say we are meant to be a harder structure. But for me to promise that suffering is easier once you eat of it would be like claiming the maple outside her window learns to endure its shadow, that birds in time enjoy the tension between eating and being eaten by something larger. If I can be trusted with truth, I would tell her how bittersweet things taste once she's ripped them from the earth and bitten down, which is how I've come to know my father, and how she will come to know me. The shadow of love thickens under a hesitant tree. Darling, I'm not ready for your wailing to stop.
Love that ending.
And that is exactly how I'm feeling. The kids are on the tail end, shall we say, of some of the teething issues. But I have another poem or two kind of sort of about the same concept. But just petrified of adulthood, knowing what adulthood does to us. You know, even people like ourselves who are, right, open-minded and empathetic and you know, hoping to leave the world having done something positive, leave it in a slightly better place than we left it, perhaps. even people like that, there is just something lost from that transition, and you know, from into adulthood. And I'm they're 10 months old now. I'm still absolutely petrified of whatever it is that I see in them now that won't be there in a few years or in 10 years. And yeah. So it's like, yeah, just stay at this age, keep screaming. You know, at least someone's listening to you. We're listening to you. Right? As adults, when we scream, no one's listening for the most part. And I guess in a relatively similar poem, actually part of the poem in the book that's closest to that last poem, maybe a compliment a bit later on, is called Lullaby for the Damned. Go ahead and scream, little one, while your voice still holds an echo. Wail yourself violently into a peaceful sleep and dream that this house we share has ears. It is okay to thrash your tiny arms and legs and eyes and soul impotently in the air. It is okay. I will thrash with you. I have never stopped thrashing or wailing. It is all that remains from what we're given. Now lay your weightlessness here on my chest and listen to what must sound like my heart. It has not been a heart or mine for many years, but it can still beat in you. And it turns out, although the kids being 10 months now are no longer weightless, shall we say, when they were weightless, and in rereading, you know, some of these poems, right when this book came out, they were probably about 3 months old, I guess. And it was really interesting reading this poem in particular, because that was the period where at 3 months, they pretty much didn't weigh, they weighed less than air, it felt like, you know, and putting them on your chest, and that it is just, such a strange feeling. I don't know if you've ever held a tiny,
not on my newborn, chest. No.
On top of your head, like a hat.
No, I haven't. Yeah, that's
But it definitely awakens whatever seemed to have been dormant or dead inside. And yeah, I don't know if this. I guess I could read maybe one more poem, I guess, from this this collection. I don't want to read, you know, too much from the same book.
No, don't give it away.
Yeah, let's just read it. Yeah, I don't want to start.
Make sure people go out and buy it, because it's a very good collection.
Well, thank you. Thank you for mentioning that. I don't have to. I always love at readings when the person who's introducing or hosting the reading is just like, oh, and there are books over there. And then you're like, oh, I don't have to say it. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Yeah. This is available at Powell's and all the other
bookstores. Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, most of the local
stores. To be honest, you probably need to get Powell's to order another one, because I just bought this.
Oh, yay!
So everyone out there, you might have to go to another bookstore.
Yes, everyone there in Portland land. I guess the last poem I read from this collection is called Optimism. To balance Lullaby for the Damned. Our children do not listen anymore. The clay has spun free of the potter's wheel. It will not harden. What are we to do with these broken, idle hands? Wisdom ricochets off without penetrating. But still we fire. We are an optimistic people. Though the whole of human history corroborates our story, our children do not listen and may finally save us. I think that's actually exactly what you were talking about earlier, about hoping that the next generation rights the wrongs. I think that's exactly what I was hoping for there.
It's up to them.
It is at this point. Well, not really, right? We're still pretty fairly young ourselves.
Our generation can still do something, I hope.
Oh, yes, come on.
It just seems like a lot of the it's just a little disconcerting to read about the politicians and realize that all the ones I read about that I don't agree with are my age. It's like...
Yeah.
So I just got a couple questions. They're kind of tangent. They're, what are you reading right now? What books are you reading? Are you reading poetry right now? Or
yeah, that pretty much is really all I read. And I hate to say that. I know it'd be nice if I branched out more. But for the most part, I only read poetry. But I do probably read about two books a week, probably. So what I'm reading right this moment, I may finish that book tomorrow, so it's hard to say. But yeah, for the most part, I'm just reading, for the most part, contemporary small press poetry. I do actually just spend a lot of time researching, actually, small presses. And
the markets, basically.
For professional reasons, certainly. Since I work as a literary agent and, for my own submissions and such. But also because that's where a lot of the kind of fresher voices, are coming out of, and that's, I'm sure, always been the case. But there's so many, almost countless, dozens and dozens and dozens of fantastic small presses, and so many of them have their own focuses, some of which, might resonate more or less with me. But there's some that are very experimental, some that are very kind of traditional and more kind of narrative and nature-based, and some that are this and some that are that. So I end up ordering lots and lots of books, all from Powell's. I pretty much do all my shopping there. And get tons and tons of small press books instead of necessarily focusing on the biggies, although I read some of those too. It's hard to say exactly what I'm reading right now. I'd actually have to pull it out of my bag.
Okay.
But I'm reading, I usually have two books going I always have two poetry books going at the same time, and I bounce between them.
Oh, wow.
I don't too often read like cover to cover one book. I'll read a few poems, and the next time I sit down to read a few poems from the other book, and then I go back to the first one, and then I wait until, and then when I've finished both books, then I grab two more books off the shelf, the to-be-read pile.
I do that a little bit. I just kind of, I kind of vary. I haven't really been reading that much poetry, I hate to say, lately. I read your book, but I just haven't been, I've been reading, like, bouncing between fiction and nonfiction lately. And I have been reading the Indigenous People's History of United States, which is kind of interesting in a different perspective. And
Howard Zinn's?
No, this is a new book. This is kind of like that, except it's from, I forget the writer, the author's name, but she's a sociologist, I believe. Maybe not. That's another book I was reading. It's a sociologist, and that's about, and the name of that, the title of that book escaped me, but that one is about, she's from Berkeley, and she went to Louisiana to understand why people would vote for Donald Trump, or when Louisiana is the most polluted state in the nation, or one of the most.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I can't remember the name of that book at all.
That kind of literature is really important. I used to read a lot more of that with Naomi Klein and so many, people like that. I used to read a lot more than that. I think a lot of it has to do with, actually, a lot of it has to do with having two babies at home now.
Yeah.
And poetry is so much easier to digest and take in little chunks, as opposed to, it's like I honestly don't always have time to even sit down and read a 30-page chapter, let alone a novel. But I do listen to audiobooks, to be fair. But apart from that, I just haven't actually cracked a novel or full length. I read books about poetry also, or sociological nonfiction or something. I definitely listen to a lot of audiobooks, which is great.
Yeah, I generally, because I'm on the commuting on the max or on the bus, I just kind of crack open a book, and a lot of times it's been short stories, that's easier. Can't remember who the last. I've kind of been bouncing between the nonfiction books lately. The other question I had was: is there a recent poetry book that would you recommend to the listeners out there?
Oh my. Ah, there's so
I'm kind of so cribbing many. This from another interview that you had.
Oh my.
You had an answer for that one, but
oh gosh, yeah. There are so many that I've enjoyed in the past, I don't even know, few months, few years. At least let's say from last year, I think kind of sort of everyone's heard of this book at this point. It kind of became huge, which doesn't usually happen with poetry. But Ocean Vuong's book, Night Sky with Exit Wounds, is definitely one of the best poetry books I'd read in the last decade. That came out last year from Copper Canyon. And I think I saw that Penguin?
Night
Sky with Exit Wounds.
By
his name's Ocean Vuong, V-U-O-N-G.
Okay.
And he, very, very young poet too. He's in his mid-20s, maybe, something like that. But I think it was actually just picked up by Penguin from, they must have purchased it from Copper Canyon.
Oh, wow.
It became that big. Yeah, he is a powerhouse of a poet. So that was incredible. But actually, last year I spent most of last year concentrating on reading almost exclusively for at least 6 months, non-straight white male poets. So, you know, some were American, some were international. But I had a good 6 to 8 months where I didn't read a single book from a straight white male.
Wow.
Which I thought was it opened my eyes in a lot of ways. Of course, you know, one reads whatever you want to read. But concentrating on not doing that for just a particular period of time, I found it was freeing and interesting, but also almost difficult to research because the American poetry landscape is, of course, so saturated with straight white male literature. And of course, I'm straight white male.
Yeah.
So I'm glad I can still find publishers. But at the same time, it is quite saturated, especially the big publishers. So it was really interesting looking for small press and international books written by people who have perhaps a different personal experiences than I do.
Did you feel like they did have a different perspective and you gained from reading all
Absolutely, yeah. Oh, every single one. But what I think more than anything else what I learned really is where things connect as opposed to disconnect. You know, the fact that the experiences perhaps that I was reading mirror things, you know, they mirrored each other and they mirror things either that I've experienced or at least could imagine experiencing.
You mean the things you were reading before then or the non-straight white male poetry was mirroring your poetry
and other poetry I've read, and absolutely it seemed like there are a lot of commonalities. There are more commonalities than differences, I think, which, you know, and that makes sense, right? I mean,
yeah,
there is that whatever it is that I guess makes us human, you know, that we all share at its very base level, we all share for the most part the same fears, the same overall hopes, and we all suffer grief in similar ways, and we all maybe approach each other in society in different ways. Sometimes, you know, more hands off. Sometimes we want to embrace society. Sometimes we're skeptical of it. Whatever it is, but in the end, all people kind of, sort of want and are scared of the same things. And so it's interesting, different people from other cultures and other nations or other backgrounds and how they approach those same topics. Because in the end, most art seems to be generally speaking about the same topics, you know, those same basic guttural human topics. But they just were approaching them from angles that just were more foreign to me, you know, since I've been very lucky and privileged to be born, as I have been, in a country that is known for its excess. and that's not the case, obviously, for the vast majority of people in the world.
Yeah, that's... No, I actually had that experience when I read an Iraqi writer. Mm-hmm. It was a book of short stories, and I read most of them. I took it out from the library, and it's... again, I'm spacing his name. I'm thinking that his last name is Sassim, but I might be wrong. And he reminded me of another writer that I know very well named Thomas Ligotti, who is a straight white writer who writes Lovecraftian horror, but their stories were very similar in tone. It was very dark, both of them. And it was very interesting to me that, you know, there's no, you know, you would think the people are all into... Ligotti doesn't have a huge audience, a decent one, but not like... But you would think, like, maybe everyone who goes to the Lovecraft Festival should read the Iraqi writer because, I mean, it's about kind of what the United States has done to that country just since we invaded, and also just how horrible everything was. And it's very... In terms of tone and everything, it's very much like a lot of the writers in that genre. And it was kind of a connection. It was a weird connection. It was very good. God, I'm going to have to leave a little bit of space to these writers I'm mentioning that whose names I can't remember.
That I just queue them up later.
That I just talk about, and I wasn't ready to mention their names.
Oh no,
but
I know what you mean. It's the same thing, I think, really, with the connections. I mean, if in film also, right? There's political. There are horror movies, for example, that at their heart are political. There are, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
there's just so many connections.
And there's a bunch of different. Genres get broken off and separated, and often they shouldn't necessarily be. I mean, there's little subgenres and weird stuff going on between, but sometimes there's a lot of overlap between someone like Ramsey Campbell and someone who'd be considered a mainstream writer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's not just that, not just stuff like that. Also, this magical realism and science fiction or fantasy are very much, there's a lot of connection between them.
Oh,
although
absolutely.
The roots are slightly different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess we're all, right? All of us as writers and poets are all at heart probably exploring the same things, right? We explore the things that keep us up at night.
The human condition.
The things that give us hope. Whatever it is, yeah. I tend to write very often more about the things that keep me up at night, as opposed to, sometimes the hope creeps in there because it's all part of the same experience.
Yeah.
But I more often than not write about things that keep me up at night, that scare me, or yeah.
So we have time for a couple more poems. If you want to read a couple more newer ones.
Sure. No, absolutely. I'd love to. I'll read. Actually, I'm going to read this as a bit more narrative too. But I'm going to read this new poem. Partly because I'm still waiting on a word. I know it's a finalist for a contest right now as we speak. So maybe fingers crossed on this one. But the title of the poem is Salvage. And this was, although I actually haven't been there myself, I had a friend that lived in the Detroit area a couple of years back. And so you can probably guess where that's going. It's unfortunately, it is a city that's been through a lot recently. And the name of the poem is Salvage. From this fourth story window, I see power lines eating sky, gray awnings blocking all light from the recesses. All neon-like, the entirety of night is captured, drowned in inch-deep puddles. A child half-buried in tarp, asleep between walls. Walls buried up to their necks in empty shelves. Overabundance of place. And scarcity of the same. Self interrogations, sag in soot. A man older than my father was when he died is converting fire hydrants to Jesus. And it seems to be working. Amen. No fire has stuck around long enough to catch. There is a boarded up church just out of reach. A weed-choked stone temple that can't shake off its steeple. Like soggy piñatas, stars just hang there, slashed open, all the sweetness torn out. Like a barren womb. Like something we must learn the worth of through trial and error. Like waiting for a god or steamroller to speak up and rephrase us. So that's one of those, since I hadn't, wasn't living in Detroit at the time, but here, obviously reading articles about it, hearing firsthand account from a friend, and then obviously one places oneself in the poem for immediacy's sake. But, Oh, I get that. Slightly political cultural there. I didn't mean to do that.
No, it's fine.
I think we're done. We're culture heavy today.
I was just thinking about the blessing of the fire hydrants.
That is something I've seen before. Was that here in Portland? No, I think it was back. I'm from Boston, but I think it was back there. I remember seeing who I believe may have been a homeless person that seemed to be blessing random, I don't know if it was fire, but random things, streetlights and stuff like that. And I just thought that was interesting. I'm not judging. Hey,
No, I'm not either.
it's fire hydrants need blessings. I guess I'll... read another one, if I may. This is actually quite a short one, and one that I'm honored to say had won a contest late last year. It's a prose poem, quite short, called Death is a Work in Progress. Similar themes to the collection, Disinheritance. My mother says, Fox, while gesturing toward an old red wagon abandoned in our yard for decades. A word so cavernous, her entire body vanishes into it. Body of misfiring electrons, scattered images, contexts. Body that is mainly just body now. No other animal knows how to be this incomplete. I think if you were a fox, coyotes would have eaten you by now. But I say, yes, I'll climb into that fox and let you pull me through the high grass one more time. Always a sad one, but...
Did you have one you wanted to end on, or...?
Oh, sure, I suppose so. Pretty new poem. It is called... It's got a little bit of everything, I think, that we've discussed earlier, from grief to cultural stuff. There's a lot here, but Instructions for Banishment. First, line your threshold with salt. Shower your dead loved ones with insults to keep them from weighing down the cold half of the mattress. If you ever get around to sleeping again, don't dream heavenly. Stay close to bone. Breath. Breathe dust and bacon fat in whatever reminds a house that you are in it. Never forget that you are in it. Scuffed up shoes and jeans worn at the knees. Stop praying. Stop playing at prayer. Let everything not bolted down drift out onto the lawn with the first rain. Let it rust there. Leave timelessness to do with the past what it must. And with your body, and what's not entirely body. I know how hard it is to arrest a song as it crescendos to a deafening roar before flatlining. Forget the lives you took or failed to take. After all, we were at war or a peace that lasted too long. We are never really at peace long enough to suffer it. Wrap your fever in cheesecloth and wait for the throbbing to subside. It will never subside. I know regret is just another word, is just another form of lust. Surviving your children is collateral damage. There is no end to why. There is no end. Throw some salt over your left shoulder. Cut the throat of every chicken in your neighbor's yard and bathe in their blood. Eat their hearts. Try on all sorts of silences until you find one that fits. Like a glove. Like a mask. A man suit. Anything to hush the voices. Then never take it off.
You've been listening to Talking Earth. This is Patrick Bocard. I'd like to thank our guest tonight, John Sibley Williams. He has been reading from his recent book, A Poetry, Disinheritance, as well as some newer work that you've just heard. And everyone have a good night.
Girl, KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Next Level 3.0's party, Vogue Beach Please, on Saturday, July 1st, from 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. at Tonic Lounge in Portland. Next Level 3.0 is a collaboration with Flawless Shade, the House of Flora, and the House of Ada, featuring KBOO's Dina B and DJ Gila River Monster, and more DJs and performers. Costumes are highly recommended. Again, that's Next Level 3.0's party, Vogue Beach Please, on Saturday, July 1st from 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. at the Tonic Lounge, 3100 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KB Portland.
The following program is an opinion piece produced independently by a KBOO volunteer. The thoughts and opinions expressed are those of the host and do not necessarily reflect that of KBOO or any of its employees. Also, this program features frank discussions of sexual acts and language that may not be appropriate for sensitive listeners. Discretion is advised.